Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So I think those two things are really important for us, from a branding perspective, at least.
Right. So that consumer interface and storytelling. And has the wines changed as well in the 4 or 5 years since you took over?
I think that's inevitable when you bring in a different winemaking team. I know personally, one thing that drew me to sort of Bob's style was I love Pinot Noirs and Chardonnays that have a combination of both a nice acid line to them as well as some texture. And I think having both of those in a wine is what makes a wine that can age, can impress, and is just enjoyable for me. So I think we tried to take the wines and kind of tweak them back into that model a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we did it slowly, and we've taken some of them probably farther and then brought them back a little bit. And we've done it both ways, where we've kind of inched some wines one way, and so it's been a great learning experience too, because like Bob was saying earlier, it's many of these vineyards were new to us working with them, at least. And so we didn't want to move too quickly and drastically change everything. We had an existing mailing list and customers who really liked what they had, and so we checked in with them as well and made sure that we were not going too far from their expectations, but we also had to sort of stay true to what we wanted to do.
It was a steep learning curve too. There were a lot of expectations with me coming in, and Ryan, we both had experience together, and to make some changes, but they needed to be thoughtful changes. And we needed to learn the vineyards. That's the key to all of this, is understanding how the fruit grows and not trying to manipulate that to something it doesn't want to be in the fermenter, in the barrels, or in a blend. And the thing I miss the most about William Salium is the vineyards. Yeah. Being, I went on to some of those ranches. I got Hirsch at Hartford Court for the couple of years I was on that ranch for 20 years.
Wow.
And you see things, you learn things, and it's invaluable information. So when you go to make decisions about the farming, or you go to make decisions in the cellar or at the crush pad, it's a much easier decision because you have more information.
Yeah.
And we're still kind of building those databases and our palates. If you haven't had block 8 at Gap's Crown, or block 4, 1A, 3B, or whatever, we have some crazy block numbers. I either call it the 8-2A. I refer to everything usually by clone, because that's how I can kind of remember it. Yeah. The 8-2A kind of on the steep hill over to the north side of the property. And everybody else will go, oh yeah, that's block this such and such. it's important to understand the farming, the grapes, and then kind of change the winemaking a little bit, or adapt the winemaking to the vineyard side a little bit. And like Ryan said, we know on a couple lots we've definitely pushed it probably too far, And so we've brought it back a little bit. Some of it's been with oak. Some of it's, we've tried different yeast strains. We've done no yeast strains. We've done native ferments. We've done punch downs. We've done pump overs. We've done delestage. We've stirred lees. We've not stirred lees. And it's going to change every vintage. So we haven't been able to set a real set of procedures. We kind of have an idea of what could be done during these weeks that we have the wine in our care. So then you have to decide, okay, is 2015 more similar to 2016 or 2017? And you start making references to the previous vintages.
you know, just the sheer number of variables you're describing, it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, mm-hmm. I've only walked, well, two vineyards from your portfolio, which portions of two vineyards, which is Gabb's Crown and Jarrell, and I'm looking at a cylinder. You know, this is actually a really cool display of various soils, and Jarrell is not a soil at all. It's just rocks.
And yeah, there is soil between it.
At least what's on display.
We kind of laugh at that one because that's what I think they wanted to accentuate to the...
There's a message in the bottle, so to speak, or in the cylinder. I'll take a picture so you guys can tell what I'm talking about. But just the shared diversity in just this tiny snapshot of what you guys get to work with on the daily basis, all the choices that would correspond in some degree, and again, the variables have to be kind of mind-boggling.
They are. If you think about it, I think.
Yeah.
As we just, you know.
Well, and you have to kind of, like, you know, Bob was saying, you have to start with sort of a general framework for how you like to, you know, make wine to start with. And so you take that framework and you go down, but then you tweak it. You say, you know, we're at the Jarrell Vineyard and... you know, we know that those at the end of harvest, the acids will drop faster than these other sites. So we need to really watch that, and we want to keep that acidity. So let's do this. And you know, the soil at this other vineyard is requires more water or whatever it is. And then you go back to the other vintages and you look and you say, yeah, this is feeling like it's turning out to be more like 2017, and we did this and we didn't really like the way this turned out, or we really loved how this turned out. Let's do that again or tweak it a little ways. So it is, and that's winemaking is just, you know, hundreds if not thousands of decisions put back to back, and you know, each one of them are very important. If you tweak maybe one of those things, it could go wildly one way or maybe not. You know, sometimes those decisions are not significant, and you have to know when that's true as well, and just roll with it sometimes.
How big is Jarrell?
Jarrell's 130 acres planted.
My goodness.
So
think about that number. That's a lot right there. Just one vineyard.
Just one vineyard.
And soil variation.
But the ranch,
like,
itself is
crazy.
600,
five or 600 acres. It's huge. So it's not like they're all in one spot.
No.
You go up over these hills, you go down into the flats where all that rock is.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's very different. There's probably 30 different soil and microclimates just on Jarrell.
Yeah.
At Jarrell, we have some soil that looks much like the one sky, which is more volcanic and red soil. There's within our blocks alone, we've got four very distinct soil types and even sort of little microclimates. There's little valleys that collect wind in different ways, and then the valley floor, and you got some that are on the side of a hillside versus sort of in a bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things come into play when we're looking at growing and harvesting the fruit.
Assume it keeps you on your toes all the time. You can.
It does. It feels. I think sometimes Rob. You know, Rob said it a couple times. You know, he just feels like he's behind all the time. No matter when, even when he's caught up, he's like, I still feel like I should be doing something. Like, you don't feel like it's completed, because it's not. It's still growing. So
absolutely,
it's changing day in and day out.
And this is also a very unique set of circumstances, because you get to work with a cohesive team, the vineyard management piece of it, which a lot of companies, a lot of wineries outsource. Mm-hmm. You actually have in-house, essentially, and somebody with vast amount of experience. And that piece is exceptionally important, because that communication is probably one of the most crucial components to the final product, is that teamwork with Rob and constantly exchanging information and tweaking things. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, having Rob, Rob is super thoughtful, and you know, is out all the time. You know, to farm the way that we want our grapes to be farmed, it's got to be a full-time thing. You know, we're out there a lot, but he's out there all the time, and you know, and looking at it daily, hourly. You know, he'll talk about, you know, how the wins at Doral come in at, you know, 3:30 every day and this, and you know, you've got to be out and really kind of live and breathe with those vines to be able to do that. And so having him out there sort of being the eyes and ears and the, you know, organizing all of the things that need to get done on a daily basis is crucial. I think, you know, when we spend a lot of time in the vineyard, obviously it gets more and more as you get closer and closer to harvest, but there's still really important times, you know, beforehand where we've got to be out there and we're working collaboratively with him. Yeah. And it's similar, you know, we'll say, well, what about this? You know, cause we're coming at it from a wine's perspective. You know, what do we want to do with these grapes once they come into the winery? You know, are we looking for more of a tannin profile or less? And that changes between winemakers. You know, it's not right or wrong. It's yeah. just style. And so we work with him to say, you know, let's open up the canopy a little bit more. Let's get a little bit more sun on this. Or, you know, we want the tannin profile to be this way. Or we're using whole clusters. We think we're going to use more whole cluster on this. So let's make sure we get a little bit more, you know, lignification on the stems. So it's a big collaborative effort for sure.
You know, just from a consumer point of view, if you really want to geek out, just buying a bottle of Doral fashioned by different producers and hopefully including 3-6 and just following through yeah. that thread in the horizontal format.
We do those tastings all the time and it's fascinating to see what the other winemakers are doing. And we know the blocks because we've got all the block maps and we know who gets this block and who gets that block. And after a while, you know, we'll even have conversations with those winemakers and, you know, did you put in some whole cluster?
Yeah.
Do you inoculate with certain yeast? You know, so that we have the information once we've tasted the wines and we can have a thoughtful discussion afterwards. I don't think it's a right or wrong. We laugh sometimes when we rank 3-6 up at the top. We all start, house palate. We start... Yeah. joking with one another, but it's also what we like the taste of.
You always recognize, you know, it blind?
I would say for the most part.
Yeah, it's yeah. you sometimes you get surprised. Sometimes you're, you know, I think one thing that's really cool about doing that is you do see some similarities between, so the vineyard does tend to show itself throughout. So sometimes that can trick you a little bit. Or if styles are similar, you mm-hmm. might...
And they get blocks. Yeah. You split block, the same blocks with people, and you go, okay. Then there really is a common thread. And sometimes that would be part of the tasting. Bill would say, okay, pick two words that you feel are common threads. So as you're doing your tasting notes, what two words are you using for Gap's Crown? Or yeah. what two words are you... You know, and it could be from... racy acidity to, you know, lush full tannins to
yeah.
cherry, kirsch, yeah. whatever. Yeah.
I think
and then we would kind of compare those.
Wow.
I was just gonna say, I think what's really interesting with those is that you do generally, even though there is that vein that goes through all of it, you do see vast differences as well. And and that's what's really cool. It's different yeah. interpretations of the same or similar fruit. Or in some of the cases, like Doral, you do have all of these different zones and areas and microclimates and soils. So they are going to make slightly different wines from those different areas anyways, especially if you add on top of that winemaking style.
And you said you do those tastings all the time. Like how often?
When it's not harvest, you know, every couple of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, like barrel samples, you know,
no, usually
finished wines.
Finished wines, yeah. Bill okay. has a great collection of wines, and if we can't find one out in the marketplace, I don't know how many lists he belongs to. We get a hold of Bill, and he'll send us the list sometimes. It's like, okay, let's get... And sometimes we'll plan out, because he does keep some of his wines like at Binfolio. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he has them stored in a nice temperature controlled place, but they're also cataloged. So we'll say, okay, we're going to do a 2016 Gap's Crown Chardonnay tasting, which we don't, there's not a lot of Chardonnay out there. Mm-hmm. And we'll collect those bottles over a 3-month period. And then try to incorporate them in while we're also doing barrel tastings with Bill.
Here's the blends we came to.
Yeah, oh no, it's awesome. And I don't think enough wineries spend that kind of money to...
William Selling,
we did a little bit of outside tasting. I tried to do like a couple times we did like a Grand Cru Burgundy tasting. And, you know, we did it out at the farmhouse and had them cook lunch for us and everything. And I think all of those educational processes are very important to not just winemaking, but marketing and sales and even the administrative staff. Because everybody's got a palate that I think needs a voice.
Do you include wines from Burgundy, for instance, or Oregon? I mean, is that a
typical? Yeah. Oregon, New Zealand.
Yeah.
We'll do just New World Pinots and throw a Three Sticks in.
Yeah.
And see how are we doing against, or we'll do, you know, just Sonoma Coast.
Yeah.
And Sonoma Coast, I mean, my gosh, it can be from it can be from San Pablo Bay all the way up to the Mendocino border. I mean, that's, you might as well be saying Sonoma County.
What were some of the bigger surprises that you've encountered, just kind of generally throughout those tasting experiences? Anything stood out as a pattern repeating or something, you know, individual instance that really caught your attention?
I think for me, the things that I love about those tastings is that you go in with certain preconceived notions about what to expect, either from your past history or just the marketing of a region or, you know, and then you go and you actually taste the wine and you taste it blind and they're intermixed with, you know, so we've done tastings where we've done Burgundy, Oregon, New Zealand, and California all in the same tasting, completely mixed up. And so we're trying to figure out what's different, what's not. And you come away sometimes finding new wines that you love and or from regions that you thought, you know, was going to show one way and it actually didn't. And we found a New Zealand Chardonnay on one of ours that, you know, I tend to buy whenever I can see it on a wine list now, because it's very Burgundian. I'm kind of totally intrigued by it every time I try it.
Yeah. New Zealand is of course very well known for its Sauvignon Blanc, but Chardonnays there, I actually concur. The ones that I've had on my visits were really pretty significant and seems to be very undersung.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chardonnays and Pinot. We were just in France a month ago, and somebody I've built a friendship with over the years is a guy named Francois Milat, who is the winemaker since about mid-80s, right? 85 mm-hmm. or 86 at Domaine Comte de Vogel.
Comte de Vogel.
Yeah, up in Chamonix-Mousseny. And so he received us at the Domaine, and we got to barrel taste the 18s. Of course, nothing's going through ML, but that. What's funny is that as you get to know these winemakers, they don't apologize to us anymore, because we know, you know, it's not there. You show up in Burgundy in March, they're not going to be through ML. Nobody's house virtually is going to be, unless it was just one of those years where everybody's MLs went. But he invited us over to his house afterwards for an aperitif. And I think it was 6 or 7 bottles later. But he's involved in he and Michelle, his wife, are involved in a project down in New Zealand with mm-hmm. Blair Walters.
That's right.
At Felton Road. And I mm-hmm. think Blair's wines are some of the best New World Pinot and Chardonnays I've ever experienced. And it was fun having him show us those first couple of vintages, and he was very proud of them and really kind of wanted to know our opinion on what we thought of the wines. And it was just, it's that kind of camaraderie and what makes it fun being in the wine business.
Yeah.
And where I was leading to this with your question was, have I found anything that's, you know, really noteworthy? Every time I taste, tasting is about memory.
Yeah.
So the more you taste, the more reference points you have. For me, as I get to taste more and more of these wines, I'm more intrigued on what the winemaker did than necessarily how the wine turned out.
Hmm. Interesting.
And for that reason at times, and I told Ryan and I've told younger winemakers and assistants, don't get like this. I have a hard time enjoying just sitting and enjoying a glass of wine because it intrigues me. And I want to know, well, what kind of yeast did they use? What kind? Why is that? What is that barrel taste? You know, in that Sauvignon Blanc. Well, I investigated this recently, and it was acacia wood. And I was like, have we tried acacia wood? And it's like, no, should we? Well, you know, you go buy a couple more bottles of wine, try it. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I wouldn't want a lot of that taste in my wine. But, you know, something different, something intriguing. So for me, every time we get to taste, it's just another learning experience. And I cherish that every time I get to sit down and taste, if it's just Gap's Crown's wines or it's a mix of New World, Old World.
You know, it's such an important point. I was about to ask you to give some advice to the consumers that are listening, but I think you already have. Just in the sense that the more you have exposure, the more you get, eventually you will get to know your palate relatively well, even as it evolves and changes. But I don't know of any other way of doing it. And of course, they don't have the opportunity, most of us, I should say, don't have the opportunity to taste in that kind of illustrious panel setting, don't have as much access. But what would you suggest in a practical sense for an average person?
Buy the glass programs. Yeah. To be honest, I buy a lot of wine by the glass.
Yeah.
And I'll spend $6, and some I've spent $60 here recently just because it intrigued me. Like, I've never had that wine before. And it doesn't have to be in a formal setting. And it's okay that you don't like something.
Yeah.
I'm not against making orange wines.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like them. I have tried to like them. I have made them, and I don't like them. But I'm not here to judge those that do like them.
Yeah.
You know, my palate is my palate. It's not Ryan's, and it's not yours. And if you enjoy those wines, buy them by all means. Drink them. Don't be ashamed of your palate, is the advice I would give to a consumer.
Okay.
And don't be pressured into, like, this is such a great wine. You're going to love this. Yeah. And then you don't.
Yeah.
That's okay. You don't have to be mean about it and tell the guy that spent $2,000 on the bottle that you don't like the taste of it. It's okay. Just politely dump it in the bushes.
I think that's great advice. I think it isn't intimidating.
It is. And wine shouldn't be. I'm not intimidated by the wine itself.
Yeah.
I'm intimidated a bit by the process at times.
To liberate your palate is your
liberate.
Thing. Love it.
And I think that's what's great about great and difficult for us, because there are so many choices.
Yeah.
You know, and finding what we used to call brand loyalty, I don't know, does that exist anymore? I think there's a certain amount of it, but I find even myself wanting to, I don't like to eat at the exact same restaurant all the time.
Yeah.
I live up in Healdsburg, and there's, I think the population's barely 12,000 people. We must have like 8 Mexican restaurants, and I like to eat at all 8 of them. And that's the debate when we finally drill down at home, where do you want to have Mexican food? And then we start arguing about, well, I want to have the Camarones. I want to have this. I want to have the enchiladas over here. And I think that's how it is with wine, too. You know, just whatever you're in the mood for, don't be ashamed of your palate. Your palate is your palate, and that's what makes you unique, and you should be proud of that.
Nice words. And on top of it, there's been a string of great vintages in California alone. I think 11 was just really the last one that people kind of are still traumatized by to some extent, but specifically to the brand from 14 on. Every vintage seems to show up. It's different, but in a very positive way. So technically, consumers are drinking better than ever because of that and because of the skill set that you bring to the table. So odds of you getting a wine that's mediocre, particularly in a certain bracket, quality price points, they're
probably
not high.
No, it's pretty rare.
Yeah.
But there's been great vintages up in Oregon here recently.
Yes.
Too. I buy a lot of those wines up there. New Zealand's had a great string of good vintages. You know, Yeah, worldwide, there hasn't been any real disasters, I don't think.
Typically more so on yields, but quality.
Yeah. Quality-wise, no, I think, yeah.
I mean, and I think that's what's great about wine these days is you're not going to find as many flawed wines as you might have in the past.
Yeah.
You're going to find well-made. So it's really now about finding your style and wines that you enjoy. And, you know, you go into a supermarket or you go into a wine shop and you see hundreds of choices out there. And, I know as a consumer, it's always daunting for me. I'm like, I've got to choose from one of these things. So, so educate yourself on what you like and, you know, I would say pick some that you know you like and then pick some that you've never tried before and you want to expand your palate. You know, you can create your own tasting groups if you want to delve in deeper.
That's another good tool.
That's something that, you know, we do that as winemakers with Three Sticks, but I'm also a part of other tasting groups with other winemakers. You can do that at home with your friends and, you know, you could, instead of doing a book club, you could do a wine club and you get together a couple times a year or however often you can do it and buy a couple bottles of wine and taste through them. It's fun. So do it as much as you like and can.
Yeah,
and it's very inclusive. I think what you highlight is it's just talk about it. It's such a great facilitative conversation. You'll get so enthralled and engaged that you'll forget about, you know, the right terms or the right ways to taste. It's all about it's an inclusive sport, isn't it?
It should be. It's not always.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's...
We were having lunch across the street here at Grill in the Fig. And I think it was with the Coopers when we ordered a pick pool.
Yeah.
I've never had a pick pool. What is a pick pool?
Pick pool Blanc, yeah.
Pick pool Blanc.
Yeah.
It's a Rhone, Northern Rhone.
Yeah, white. Yeah.
White varietal.
White Rhone, yeah.
And so I was like, inevitably when we go out to lunch, even with suppliers, they hand us the wine list, which is a lot of pressure all the time. I hate that. I really hate that because I would say 8 times out of 10, they're picking up the bill. And do they want to spend $30 or do they want to spend $300?
Sure.
That's the first question I think you have to ask.
Yes.
And then we can kind of drill down from there. But, I mean, I thought it was just fun to try something different. And I thought I would buy more. I haven't yet, but we left the country and went to France and Portugal, and then we've just been busy. But if I get to a wine shop, I would look for pick pool again, you know?
That's just so cool.
Because it had these just really nice citrusy, acidic flavors and... It was light, it was refreshing, it went really well with the food we were having.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.